Natural Resources for April 16th, and I will open public hearings on House Bill 5002 and that public hearing on House Bill 5003.
Good morning. Madam Chair and members, happy Monday. We're going to start off this morning with key performance measures, which is under tab 4 of our presentation book to you. And you will see there the list of our key performance measures. I'm sorry, for the record, Katie Koba, Director of the Department of Agriculture. We have 15 key performance measures. If you agree with our recommendations at the end of this budget hearing, we would like to move two of those measures to secondary performance measures, which would take our list down to 13, and I will highlight those when we get to them. And then performance measure number 7, we're going to be recommending a word change in that measure, and so we'll talk about that when we get to that. But other than that, the rest of them should stay fairly close to what they are. So the first performance measure is our food safety performance measure. And this measure, in compiling this, we have identified the top 10 risk factors that fold into food safety issues. And our goal is the sum total average of those top 10 risk factors to have 80% compliance with the average. But we have gone ahead and broken down on the bottom right side of that page. You will see the list of each of those risk factors and where we are in terms of compliance with each of those. We had set a target rate of 80% compliance. In reviewing these, as you can see, we're due for 9 of the 10, we're at 90% or higher in terms of compliance. The one that has been the most difficult in working with the industry to achieve is the second one, the holding temperature factor. And I simplify this by saying food establishments, delis, that kind of thing, keeping the hot foods hot during the course of the day and the cold foods cold during the course of the day and making sure it's hitting the temperature that it should be. And we are actually expecting, because there are some new standards that go into effect, I believe, next year, that this is going to, in terms of temperature, that this is going to be even a tougher number to hit, at least for a while, for some of our food establishments. It means that they aren't going to need to make investments in either their freezer places or their warming places to keep those temperatures where they're supposed to be. So we're kind of expecting that number, at least initially, to drop. So we have toyed with the idea of changing our target, but I think right now we'll keep it at 80% and see what happens with the new standards, and then it may be that in the future we want to bump that target up a little bit higher. I think I'll pause here to see if there are questions.
That's a quick one. Yeah.
Senator Nelson's question.
You know, what I'm hearing is something like 40% of our food that we're now having in the United States is now imported. With all the pet food stuff that's coming up, there's all... How does the department handle that situation when you don't know what you're getting when it's being imported?
Madam Chair, Senator Nelson, it's actually the federal government that does the checking of the imported foods. And that's a big debate right now because of the pet food incident and the fact that funding at the federal level had decreased in the amount of food products that they are checking in terms of importations had dropped. I would expect that given this latest incident that there will be a resurgence of interest and investment at the federal level in terms of checking imported foods at the border. If we get into a situation like with the pet food where there's a recall, the feds will sometimes partner with the states to identify where those products may be in the stores, and we would support them in a recall effort. I think in the pet food case, we have not been involved. The feds are handling it themselves. But in other food recall situations, we do partner with the federal government in recalling those foods.
Any other questions?
I wanted to bring to your attention while we're talking about food safety a couple of issues that we didn't get to Thursday that are popping up and you may hear a little bit about. One is food safety around farmers markets. And there was actually a TV report, I think, Friday on this issue. We are in the process right now of working with the Farmers Market Association and related farmers markets to figure out what we should be doing in terms of food safety issues with farmers markets. They are growing in number, and they're diversifying in terms of products that they sell. And we're trying to strike the right balance between not overregulating farmers markets and keeping them as we know them, but yet making sure that we don't get into a situation where we may have a food safety incident with farmers markets. So we want to take our time in working with the industry through that issue. And then you may have heard in the past concerns around raw milk. During the last interim, there was a raw milk incident in Washington. In Oregon, commercial sales of raw milk are not allowed, but there is this notion of cow sharing, whereby, say, the three of you could go in and buy each a third of a cow, and then you could get the milk from that cow in any form that you wanted. There are some concerns that there are cow sharing operations where there are larger numbers of cows and people are just using this as an avenue to get at raw milk. And there's debates going on currently in some other states that do allow sales of raw milk and how to deal with that. So that's kind of an ongoing concern for us around food safety. With that,
does Oregon not allow sale of raw milk?
That's correct, Madam Chair, Senator Nelson. Theirs was a cow share incident, wasn't it?
It was a cow share incident.
But they do, I think, allow some regulated sales of raw milk. Okay, so Madam Chair, Senator Nelson, Washington allows licensed and inspected sales of raw milk, and I think they're under question about whether they want to continue that or not.
Thank you.
Performance measure number two is our motor fuel quality performance measure, and when we set the target for this measure, basically what we had done is looked nationally, and the national standards had about 3% of all fuel that was screened failed standard. So our goal was to reduce that number in half, and so you can see our target for motor fuel quality compliance is 98.4%. And we're actually doing very well in terms of meeting that target. We go out and regularly sample motor fuel quality, and this is to make sure that it's reaching the octane levels that are posted for the various, three different standards, so making sure that the 97 is 97 and what have you.
I have a question for you on that, Katie. There's an incident that you're probably reading from the paper where somebody, I think it was in Eugene, is suing over temperature of the gasoline.
Hmm.
And so I'm curious if you guys regulate
over the what of gas
temperature that it affects. You want to come up and just address, because when I read this KPM, I was curious to see if you actually do any testing on temperatures and it does affect the gas mileage and how the vehicle operates.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. For the record, Lauren Henderson, Assistant Director with the Oregon Department of Agriculture, Representative Dingfelder. That's called temperature compensation, and I know just enough to be dangerous, but I think I can help you just a little bit. What that is there currently is not a way to compensate for temperature as far as volume. And so it's NIST, the National Institute of Standards, is working on that testing protocol today. There's been some meetings. Our staff have been involved in that. And what it really is in the southern states, it's really a problem. Heat, cold affect that. We've done some preliminary work in Oregon. Oregon happens to have just the right temperature. It's not too hot and not too cold, which means that the compensation issue is not as wide as it might be in a hotter state or a colder state. And really what it means is when the gas is put in the tank and it has a compensation level, you may either get a little more or a little less because of the expansion of the fuel. There isn't any protocols today nor any really good math to solve that issue. It's a pretty complicated issue, and our staff have been involved in that, and there will be a national effort to figure out what needs to be done with that, and I believe we have been in contact with the person you're referring to.
Well, the reason I asked this follow-up, Mr. Chair, is that I was curious whether we regulated it or not and whether we would have been part of the lawsuit then, you know, because we allowed gasoline to be sold at a certain temperature, but it's currently not part of the protocol that you use when you're testing.
Chair Devlin and Representative Dingfelder, today there is not a standard for that in this state, so it's not a requirement to have our folks that are the retailers temperature compensate the fuel as it comes out of the dispenser. I would anticipate in a year or two, possibly on a national standard, that there might be some standards that are developed on a national level for that. There are devices out there for this, I believe, but they're very, very expensive, and it would be the effort gained and the temperature compensation would not meet what the infrastructure costs would be to the retailers. It would be huge.
And then one last question in regards to biofuels, and, you know, we spent a lot of time, and the Department of Agriculture staff was really helpful in developing the biofuels package, especially the concerns about compliance with the renewable fuel standard. So is there going to be a separate KPM to look at compliance with the renewable fuel standard, or would this be somehow factored into this KPM?
Madam,
I mean, because this is just octane, but that's a fuel standard.
It's now Mr. Chair, not Madam Chair. Excuse me.
Chair,
Representative Dingfelder. I think what we will probably do is roll that into this fuel quality standard, and maybe similar to what we did with our food safety one breakout, the pieces that deal with maybe biodiesel would be one and ethanol one and standard gasoline one. We've not created a new performance measure for that now, but as we track it and if we feel like we need to, we can.
Well, just as far as implementation of the biofuels standard, I think it would be helpful since you're the ones that are going to be doing the testing and working with the distributors. I think that would be very helpful, KPM, to look at developing for the future. Thank you for your indulgence.
Okay. If no more questions on motor fuel quality, we'll move on to performance measure number 3, which deals with invasive pests, diseases, and weed species. There is an invasive species council that was actually established by the legislature 5, 10 years ago, somewhere around there. And they publish an annual list of the top 100 most dangerous invasive species for Oregon. The Department of Agriculture isn't responsible for all of these. We work in partnership with a number of federal agencies as well as other state agencies in handling these pest diseases and weeds, but we certainly play a pretty critical role in this area. And you can see we have adjusted our target. We really want, if we've established a list of 100 tops to keep out, our target is indeed all 100 items on the list to keep out of Oregon, or if they're identified in Oregon, to quickly control and eradicate. So, for example, gypsy moth, which is on the list, we do trapping every year for gypsy moth, and our goal is to, if we find it, quickly eradicate it so it doesn't spread into a huge problem. The same with Japanese beetle, emerald ash borer, sudden oak death, all examples of things that are on the top 100 list. And since 2002, only one species on the list has become established in Oregon, and that is an aquatic snail. So that kind of sums up that performance measure, and certainly we have a number of places in our budget that contribute to this performance measure. Boy, Monday morning's a good morning to have a discussion of performance measures, huh?
We're out of time still, I think.
Okay, performance measure number 4. This relates to our weed program specifically. And what we have here is a measure addressing our biological control portion of our weed program. We estimate that we use biological control agents to target about 30% of our weed population. So unfortunately, there are not biocontrol agents available to attack every single bad weed that we have in the but we have been basically a national leader in using biological control agents for weed control in Oregon, and other states look to us and watch our program, and where we have successful agents introduced, then tap into that agent and use it for their own problems in their states. When we started our program, the world average rate of success for biological control agents is about 33%. A well-managed, sustained program should be able to achieve about 50% of success. So that's introducing an agent and getting it able to proliferate out in the wild, and actually then seeing if it is able to attack and control weed populations and actually reduce weed populations. So we went ahead and set our goal at 50% of successful introductions of biological control agents. We have just 1 year of data so far in 05, and we were at 70% success rate. So this is obviously a fairly new measure, and over time we'll have a better sense of how well we are doing with our biological control program. For the rest of our weed program, we do more typical on the ground work. We have a budget package that expands our weed grant program. We issue grants for a number of partners that do weed eradication work on the ground. So, questions for that measure?
Questions.
I'm awake this morning, I guess. I'll say why. I guess what I'm trying to get at, Katie, here, and I was looking at the different KPMs that we have on invasive species and pest management, and having spent many, many, many hours on the ground dealing with Japanese knotweed and Himalayan blackberry and a lot of other invasive species that cost a lot of money to farmers who have to spend time and effort dealing with this, and it impacts our riparian areas especially hard. And as far as how we're doing in combating these species, and either I know that it's very hard to eradicate them, but keeping them under control, and I didn't really see a KPM that really reflects that. So I guess if you have any thoughts about that and how we can track, because it is something that costs us a lot of dollars and time, and also OWEB puts a lot of effort towards it in with the Oregon plan activity. So maybe you can talk about how we can sort of get a handle on how we're doing statewide.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Dingfelder, I know we have a secondary measure with our weed program as well, so we'll go back and bring that one forward. The challenge that we have with all of our measures, I think when we first started with key performance measures last session, we had something like 24 of them. And with the diversity of our agency and the number of programs, we would need more than 24 key performance measures to really reflect everything that we do in our agency. So we've been struggling with which measures should be key performance measures. We have a number of secondary measures to look at these other programs that we have. So, again, we'll go back and see what we have for a secondary measure for the weed program. The other thing I need to remind the committee is not all weeds that we combat in the state are invasive. If they're a native weed to Oregon, it falls in a different camp, and so that is a challenge as well. And just those we tend to leave more up to private landowners or others to combat if they're not an invasive weed.
And just a quick follow-up point to that, Mr. Chair. I mean, since we have, and I know in your budget there's a monitoring position, we have a noxious weed board, and there's a lot of activities, so it would be helpful if we could have a measure that says, what are we getting for our investment of our dollars? And I know it's not just, I mean, I understand forestry is also working on this OWEB, so, you know, and I don't know if OWEB tracks that through there, because they have a comprehensive monitoring program and a database, so if there's any way to capture that through the information that OWEB's collecting, I think that would be helpful as we're looking at funding these programs or expanding these programs.
For the record, Lisa Hansen, Deputy Director with the Department of Ag. We'll go back and talk with the weed program and see if there's something we can bring back in summary of what they've done with the weed grants that would link some of that together for you to get that information back to you.
Great, thank
quicker
you.
Rather than just the measure, and then we'll talk about more opportunities.
And it could be something for next session, but I think given that we do invest a lot of money, and part of its lottery funds.
Yes, Senator Nelson.
Is there a definition? What is a native plant, Oregon? Do you have a list of native plants, or how do we determine what's native and not native?
Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson, I'm pretty sure there is a native plant list. We'll go back and talk to our plant folks.
Yeah. We had a bill the other day where they were talking about native mammals, and I was thinking, well, saber-toothed tiger, is that a native mammal? Or mastodon? There probably were some.
Okay. Anything additional? Let's go on to E.
Okay. Performance measure number 5 deals with our threatened and endangered plant program. This is actually a program that was the funding, the state funding was discontinued during the budget cut period, I think one of the special sessions. The funding was reinstated last legislative session. So we've had a period of time here where we have not done much work around our threatened and endangered plant program. When the funding was eliminated, we moved this performance measure kind of into the side hiatus position. We have now brought it back since the program was refunded. This was a measure that was amended maybe a couple sessions ago. I can't remember for sure.
Last session.
Okay, last session. And the measure basically says that we would track the number of plant species not listed in Oregon as a threatened or endangered plant species where the Department of Agriculture played a role in keeping it not listed. So this would come at the issue in that if we're doing our job well and working with plant species that could get on a threatened and endangered list, our goal is to keep it off a threatened and endangered list. And I think off the top of my head, we probably have 55, I believe, threatened or endangered plants listed in Oregon. So obviously we continue to work with those plant populations as well to try to move them off of the list. That isn't necessarily reflected in this measure. Some examples of threatened or endangered plant species: Spalding's catchfly, which is in Wallowa County and has been the topic of a number of conversations because the Nature Conservancy has purchased land in Wallowa County to help preserve that plant species. Wire lettuce in Malheur County, and I don't think I've ever seen wire lettuce. I have no idea what it looks like, but it sounds pretty interesting. And then there's a lily, Howell's Mariposa lily, that's located on the coast, and I think Oregon is pretty much the only state or place in the world where this lily exists. The threatened and endangered plant program only works on species on publicly owned lands. So that's a little different than what you see in a threatened or endangered animal species program. So we do work on the ground to identify where these populations are at, where they could thrive, and then work to keep them viable in Oregon.
Questions? Seeing none?
Okay.
I do have a question.
Yeah.
Which I guess seems like a silly question, but why those particular plants do you want to keep viable in Oregon? I'm not advocating we extinct species of plants or whatever, but is there some reason that I'm not capturing?
Mr. Chair, Senator Avakian, they are native plant species to Oregon. There is concern with development on private lands that impacts those plant species, and I think there are those that are much more eloquent in their advocacy of plant species, native plant species, than I am, but a real desire to maintain those populations and also kind of as an indicator of what's going on environmentally with some of our landscapes. So maybe not the best answer, but I can certainly have someone from like the Nature Conservancy or others follow up with you.
No. Okay. Thanks. Nice shot.
Well, in our budget hearings, we don't go there.
I didn't know if maybe they served some particular purpose in the ecosystem, or we just don't want to kill species. And you think your answer was just fine. Don't worry. That's fine.
Moving on to Measure 6, which I know at least someone at this table has a lot more knowledge than perhaps we do on teeny plants. And this is our key performance measures, the measure dealing with our pesticide program. And the goal with this measure, what we are measuring is the percentage of pesticide investigations that result in enforcement actions. Our goal is to keep that at a minimal level. What we want to do is work through education and outreach with pesticide users in this state to make sure they are in compliance with the label, using the pesticide properly, so that they don't get into trouble. And that truly is our goal. We're a little bit up and down with this measure. As you can see, our initial target was 25% of investigations that resulted in enforcement actions. We have moved that target down over time to an ultimate target of 15% of investigations that would result in an enforcement action. You can see that of the data that we have, 03 was our best year at 11.1%. 02 and 04 were also relatively good. We had a little bump up in 06, up above the target of 15%. We're hopeful in the future that we can work hard to keep that target a realistic target. I think given some recent activities in this program, in this coming interim, we will be refocused on our pesticide program and how we can do a better job of education and outreach so that we're really getting to folks and making sure they're using these tools properly.
Are we seeing much changes? And the reason I ask this is in federal regulations, because not during this last interim, but the interim before that, I had the good fortune to be asked by the governor's office to meet with interests around pesticide use reporting for 6 months. And
you remember it well.
which actually led to no conclusion, almost like the Measure 37 discussion.
Almost made it through. I made it 35 minutes.
Pretty good.
But what we noticed is that some of the things were changing. Are we still seeing a lot of changes?
For the record, Lisa Hansen. Mr. Chair, you're correct. EPA continues to evaluate the pesticide products, and there are many products that are on phase-outs, depending on the types of products, those being restricted use or we refer to them as the hottest products that could have more potential for creating either human health or environmental harm, and there is a movement towards softer pesticides that can be better used in integrated pest management systems.
And Mr. Chair, I think that one of the other challenges that the industry in Oregon faces, because again we are so diverse and we don't have a large volume of any particular crop product, we often find that we have to go after special uses of pesticide products that aren't registered for specific crops in Oregon. It's called a Section 18. And so we probably issue a very high number, percentage-wise, of Section 18s in this state compared to other states around the United States. So, again, trying to find the right tools and then making sure that applicators are using those products correctly is very, very important.
Just to follow up, is the commercial applicator or is the farmer applicator that you have most of the violations with?
Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson, I'd have to go back and look at our data to be able to narrow that down, and I can do that, and we'll get back to you with an answer for that.
Yes, Senator Garrard, or Representative Garrard.
Thank you. This will piggyback on the Senator's question. When it comes to your enforcement, what area or areas of the state are less in compliance?
Mr. Chair, Representative Garrard, again, we can go back and look at the data. I'm guessing that there isn't particular areas of the state that tend to be more in compliance than others. You may have heard we just recently had an incident in Malheur County with onions, but I don't think we see particular trends with geographic parts of the state.
Mr. Chair, Representative Garrard, I think the most common trend that I see is as we go through our civil penalties that we issue, they typically are licensing issues where there are people that need a license and don't have the appropriate license within an organization.
Okay. Anything additional?
Maybe what we can do, Mr. Chair, is if it's easy for us, break down like we did in food safety and get a little more specific, you know, types of violations, maybe license versus use, because Lisa's correct. It's really not the use side that we very rarely see an appropriate use. And then commercial versus private or something. That's easy to do. Okay, key performance measure number 7. This is one where we are going to recommend wording change. And this is really related to the incredible changes that we're seeing around certification in the marketplace. And this is an international phenomenon. It's not just Oregon or the U.S. market, but truly a global market issue, and I think you've all heard about a package pending which would help us in the certification area. But we started out in the agency. We were one of the first states in the United States that was in the position to provide certification for good agricultural practices, good handling practices. We worked with USDA to set up this audit certification program in Oregon. And so this measure initially dealt with just the good agricultural practices, good handling practices certification program where we actually perform the audits. And it reflects the number of acres that are certified under the good agricultural practices audit program and the number of handling packaging facilities, we call them packing sheds, that are certified under good handling practices audit. But what we are seeing because of the growing number of certification programs and our goal to not only conduct audits for some certification programs, but really provide technical assistance to the industry when they're interested in becoming certified, is we want to change this measure, and you'll see the proposed headline language right at the top where it says, note, new wording has been proposed for this measure, speaking specifically to certification broadly, where we would track the number of acres certified where the Oregon Department of Agriculture provided technical assistance or auditing services. So really trying to capture where we hope we are going with our work around certification.
Does the certification include organic farms, or is it?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Nelson, yes, it does. Organic is probably one of the earliest certification programs, but now we're moving into a variety of sustainable certification programs, Live, Salmon Safe, Food Alliance, Europe Gap, Identity Preserved, being able to track product from the farm to the consumer. We do audit work and identity preserved work for the industry in that way. So it's just really proliferating. It's pretty amazing. Okay.
Has this been a basically a fee for service or a general fund program? Or?
Mr. Chair, the good agricultural practices, good handling practices is all fee for service. And what we would propose, if the agency is conducting the auditing program, that would be on a fee for service basis. But you will see a package where we are requesting general fund support for technical service. So this would be not where we are necessarily conducting, well, it wouldn't be where we're conducting the actual audit itself, but let's say Representative Garrard grows blueberries. He is interested in exporting blueberries to the UK. He may come to us and say, should I be certified? If so, what program should I be certified under? If I want to do UK and Safeway, is it the same program? Is it a different program? Can you take a look at what's happening on the ground and my record keeping and my in compliance? Where are the areas that I need to improve to actually be prepared to become certified? We would provide that technical assistance, and then we may not conduct the audit itself. It might be Food Alliance that comes in and conducts the audit for Representative Garrard, or EuropeGAP that comes in and does the audit. So where we provide technical assistance may not necessarily mean we actually conduct the audit ultimately.
Does the fee cover your entire cost, or is it we're back to the 30% thing or whatever it is?
Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson, the fee covers our entire cost, and we have a package where you will see this as well in our shipping point program.
Chair, are you interested in buying some blueberries?
It doesn't matter to me, Representative Garrard, but I would assume you're an organic blueberry.
Absolutely, Mr. Chair.
Okay, moving on. We're halfway through our measures. You don't want to grow blueberries, though.
No, I got nothing against blueberries. Okay. Representative Garrard's blueberries.
Mr. Chair and members, the next four measures all are related to our marketing, agricultural development and marketing division, and this has probably been one of the areas where it's been the most difficult for us to kind of zero in on what are the right measures to have for that program. And of these four measures, we're going to actually recommend that two of them be moved into the secondary category, and we keep two of them as primary measures. The first one, key performance measure 8, we would like to keep as a primary measure. Number 9, we would propose to move as a secondary measure. Number 10, move to a secondary measure. And number 11, keep as a primary measure. And basically, key performance measure number 8 and number 11 tend to be kind of the standard measures used in an economic development activity. Number 8 deals with sales, so where we would work with companies and hook them up with sellers. We would track our activity. We would circle back with the companies that we worked with and actually track sales that they actually got as a result of our assistance with that company. So kind of the sales tracking number. And so far you can see we've had a target in 2003 of $40 million in sales, moving up in 2009 to $43 million in sales, and we're right on target in terms of actual activity with the sales work.
Questions about key performance measure 8?
Jumping then, let me move ahead to measure 11, because that's, again, kind of the industry standard, would be tracking jobs created. Jobs retained or jobs created as a result of our work with companies in Oregon. And it's a new measure for us. We had estimated in 2005 230 jobs either saved or created, and we reached 250. We had targeted 250 jobs. Actual jobs that we tracked were 230. So, again, I think over time it's a matter of seeing where we're at and adjusting accordingly. But number 8 and number 11 are the two that we would propose to keep at the primary level. Then number 9 and number 10 deal specifically with new companies that we work with, and we do a variety of activities in trying to help new companies establish in Oregon. And then number 10, processing. We work to keep value-added processing in Oregon and recruit new processing to Oregon. So this reflects amount of investment in new plants or equipment in existing plants in the processing sector. And both of these measures we would recommend to move to secondary.
Thank you, Katie. Representative Garrard had a question.
Katie, on number 9, will that? I mean, we're expecting a pretty good increase in the biofuels area. Will biofuels be reflected in this key performance measure?
Madam Chair, now, Representative Garrard, yes. We did talk about capturing biofuels companies in this measure, and then we have created a new secondary measure that we will get to when we get to our renewable energy package that's linked to the goal of reaching 25% of the U.S. energy independence by the year 2025. So we want to kind of track how we're doing in Oregon in terms of energy that's coming from not fossil fuels. So we're trying to get at that opportunity in a couple of different measures. Moving right along.
EFOs.
EFOs. Senator Avakian, this one's for you. I know you'd like this one. Confined animal feeding operations are...
Actually, this one's for you.
Right. For us together. This measure tracks the percent of permitted operations, confined animal feeding operations in Oregon that are found to be in compliance with their permit during their annual inspections. And just a reminder that CAFOs are inspected for water quality impacts, not for air quality impacts. The target, you can see in 99, we started at 50% when the program was new of CAFOs in compliance, with the target moving to 95% in 2004 and staying at that number. We are doing very well. In 2005, we're at 92% compliance, so 92% of the annual inspections that we did were in compliance with their permit. You can see in 2003 that we had dropped down to 78%. This was when the new federal permit came out, and so the standards basically went higher, and it took a little bit of time for some of our CAFOs to come into compliance with the new higher standards, but we're very pleased with where our CAFO program is going in the state. And just for those of you who care, we are the national standard is the National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System NPDES permit that the CAFOs are permitted to.
It's like Representative Burling and Representative Clem has questions.
Madam Chair, is clean water the the only thing that Department of Ag regulates with CAFOs?
Madam Chair, Representative Burley, yes, but we go a little bit further than some of the other states in that we also look at groundwater. So it's not just surface water impacts from CAFOs, but also groundwater impacts, and that's not a requirement, I believe, of the federal permit.
You're correct.
And then in Oregon, we also, you have to have a certain number of animals before you're triggered into the federal permitting system. And if you're below, I think it's if you have 200 animals or less, you're not considered a federal CAFO. Oregon is also unique in that for our state permits, which are 200 animals or less, we meet the same federal standards as all of our other CAFOs, and that is not true in other states as well. So we have a very high standard in terms of our CAFOs in Oregon and their impacts on water quality.
Who owns the cattle when they're in the CAFO being fattened for slaughter? Who owns them?
Madam Chair, Representative Burley, it depends. and it does vary. And you have to remember, CAFOs, we've got dairy facilities, so that typically is owned by the farmer. They're his cows that he's milking. It's not the animals going to slaughter. We have poultry CAFOs. In those situations, a lot of them, the farmer's on contract with the processor. So that's the kind of the relationship there. We have goat CAFOs for feedlots, which I think was what your question was specifically targeting. It could be the feedlot owner. The feedlot owner could purchase the cattle and fatten them on their feedlot, or it could be on contract with the owner who sends the cattle to the feedlot. The owner owns the cattle, but the feedlot manager is fattening the cattle.
So in the last example, where the
rancher still owns the cattle, but they're being finished in the CAFO. If something were to happen to those cattle, they die for whatever reason, who's responsible for that?
Chair, Representative Burley, that would be up to whatever agreement the owner and the feedlot manager have. I would assume, I would hope that there's a contract in place that would spell out how they would handle that situation. If there's a CAFO issue, the CAFO permittee, which would be the feedlot owner, would be responsible. So if you had a discharge, it goes to the permit holder of the CAFO, not necessarily the owner of the cattle.
So one last
I'm curious where this is going.
Well, where it's going, Madam Chair, is that there was an incident, somebody that we know that actually raises cattle and had them being finished at a feedlot, and they died, and there was a huge issue, still is, to my knowledge, outstanding over who's responsible for the loss of the head. And what I'm trying to get at here is there's no uniformity in the state in how this works. There's no regulatory oversight by the department. So as the director pointed out, it's hit or miss depending upon the individual feedlot and what type of agreements there are. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Representative Clark?
I changed my mind.
Okay.
I'm going to ask offline.
Okay. Any questions down here? I had a quick one. How many permanent CAFOs do we currently have in the state of Haiti? I don't know if you know that off the top of your head, but I'm sure one of your trusty folks back there will.
Madam Chair, it's around 550 permitted facilities.
I know, we're just trying to confuse the committee.
There's a definition of CAFOs. There has to be a certain number of animals before you. But I was thinking about the sheep guys out there north of Pendleton now. He's got 3,000 or 4,000 head of sheep, and he runs about 160 acres.
Just for clarification about our Oregon CAFO program, all of the dairies in Oregon are signed up to the NPDES permit because they have a wastewater treatment system. We also have dry CAFOs that are state CAFOs, and that's determined by the number of days the animals are confined, and it's not by size. So it breaks into a couple different programs, and it's a little more complicated.
And just a clarification or follow-up to Senator Nelson's question, it doesn't matter the type of animal, it's about the number of days of confinement.
That is correct.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
If you fed your stock more blueberries, you wouldn't have this problem.
How's he blueberries?
Okay.
I have very little background in that problem, but I won't go there. I think you might have problem feeding stock blueberries.
Or cherries.
That's not a good picture.
Shall we move on, Mr.
Yes.
I had the committee under the control until the chair came back. I just wanted to note that.
Key Performance Measure 13 is another very popular program. It's our smoke management program. And with this measure, we set as kind of our target year, we did not want to have an increase above 2002 levels in hours of significant smoke intrusions due to field burning in key cities in the Willamette Valley as measured by nephelometer readings. So in 2002, you can see we had 8 impact hours. We set that as our target. We did well in 2003 and 2004. In 2005 and 2006, we had a couple, two in both cases, incidences that bumped us above our target. And this is really one of the challenges that we have with field burning. We have a meteorologist on staff. We constantly monitor the weather, and it's the weather conditions that determine whether you can burn or not. We had perfect ideal weather conditions for burning, gave the green light. The smoke went up, and the weather changed, and the smoke came right back down on Springfield. And we stopped burning when we saw the weather change, but with the smoke that had already gone up, we did have impact hours on Springfield in 05. And then both in 05 and 06, where we typically see moderate impact is in Lyons. It's where we're directing the smoke. We are directing the smoke to move east up over the Cascades, and Lyons just happens to be in the path and typically has smoke impact. But you can see in 05, we had 19 hours. In 06, we had 13 hours. We had a unique situation last year in 06. We had a farmer who hasn't burned a lot in a field near Corvallis and burned his field and didn't get it hot enough. So instead of the smoke moving up and out as it would, if it was a hot fire, it kind of smoldered and slowly drifted into Corvallis. Representative Geiser, I know, remembers that well. So some of the challenges, and I think in this program, making sure that producers know how to burn if they're going to burn is a lesson that we learned there. So you can see that is our field burning measure.
Yes, Representative Garrod.
Katie, you may choose not to answer this question, and that's acceptable. But are any further restrictions necessary in field burning, in your opinion?
Mr. Chair, Representative Garrod, there's obviously been discussion on that topic this session. I think both our agency and the Department of Environmental Quality, we're in close communication as well as with public health to make sure that we have minimal impacts from field burning on populations or on human health. There are plenty of statistics going around and in the building. I think our goal truly is to continue to constantly look at the program and figure out ways to minimize impact. And we're also brainstorming a little bit on how we might give better notice to potentially affected individuals, particularly those that suffer from asthma and definitely have an impact when there is burning, and if there's something we can do creatively to help better communication.
Very well done.
Next measure? This measure is, this is a great measure. This is a very complicated measure, so I'm going to do the best I can to walk you through it, and we brought in the expert if I get stuck. This is our measure for our water quality program, our Senate Bill 1010 program, and this is a measure that we have lifted from the Department of Environmental Quality, and we've specifically tailored it to stream. So DEQ is monitoring streams that are listed. We are, for our measure, monitoring stream sites associated with predominantly agricultural use. But it is DEQ data that we use, and I think that is one of the shortfalls that we have right now, frankly, in our water quality program, is the ability to monitor. We are very supportive of DEQ's budget to get additional dollars into monitoring, because just being able to monitor streams with predominant agricultural use is a challenge for us. When you see the three charts on the right, the chart that we're trying to get everyone into is the middle chart. The middle chart says, measures the percent of monitored stream sites with good to excellent conditions. And you can see our target for 04 was 50% of stream sites, so stream sites with predominantly agricultural use, are moving our target up to 60% in 2009. In 2004, we were at 51%, so we're meeting our target. The graph on the top has streams where the water quality is improving. So our goal is to get it to improving, and once it hits good, then it goes to the middle. So, again, you can see in 2004, 35% of stream sites was our target. We reached that target. Streams where we're seeing improving trends in water quality, and our target is to move that to 33% in 2009. So those 2% of streams, we're hoping to hit the good threshold, and in that case, they go to the middle graph. The graph on the bottom are stream sites where we have decreasing trends in water quality. In 2003, you can see the actual number was 17%. Our target in 2004 is 10%. We don't have the data in yet from DEQ. We want to move that to 8% in 2009. So the streams on that one would want to hit into the increasing trend, so they would go to the top graph. and then the top graph goal to the middle graph. So our goal is to get streams into the good to excellent category. We do have streams where we have decreasing trends. We need to reverse that, and we want to keep getting our increasing trends up. That is a description of our water quality performance decision.
How do you select which sites to monitor? Now, depending upon how you look at this, if you decide to select sites where you believe there may be an issue, then you wouldn't. It'd be normal that your results would be.
Sure, we'd never do that.
No. Is it just random or?
Chair Devlin, members of the committee, my name is Ray Jandel. I'm the administrator of the Natural Resources Division. Sites that are selected are actually developed by DEQ. They have a number of ambient monitoring sites around the state, and our specialists, our hydrologists, reviewed all those sites to determine which areas were associated with predominantly agricultural lands. We didn't know what the status of those sites were. We just knew that we're looking for a block of land that was predominantly agriculture influenced by ag, and he was able to identify those and select those. Apparently because the data existed, that's why they were selected. Other than that, that's the process we used.
Question?
Yes.
Ray, DEQ finds a stream that's got a real pollution problem due to agriculture. They call you, and what do you do at that point?
We work cooperatively with DEQ. We've been since 97 when Oregon Plan for Salmon and Watersheds came around, and they are responsible for developing the TMDLs around the state, and so our process fits into theirs. They don't specifically look for agriculture. They just say this stream, this water is not meeting the standard, whether it's for temperature, coliform, bacteria, whatever, and then the various agencies that might have influence on those get involved. In our case, we have been developing the Senate Bill 1010 plans around the state, and so we would have identified those with the local community and said, these are the issues that were identified, these are the ag activities that could be impacting that, and these are some opportunities to overcome that and still productively farm.
Follow, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
So you give the owner the opportunity of someone else to work with on the issue rather than DEQ?
Chair Devlin, Representative Garrard, that's correct, yes.
Yes, Senator Nelson.
Question, maybe this is for Paul too. Is it, we've cut the DEQ budget. Did we cut, in the proposed co-chair's budget, we've cut the DEQ budget. How will this affect this?
I have to defend the co-chair's occasion, even though I don't necessarily like it. We could cut the proposed increases in the budget. The co-chair has recommended cutting some of the proposed increases in the budget.
With this particular thing, we work with the DEQ. If DEQ doesn't have to do the monitoring, how does this affect your program?
Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson, there's nothing in the co-chair budget that I know of that would cut the base monitoring program for the water quality ambient network. They have a network of ambient water quality sites around the state that they've been updating for years, and there's nothing that I know of that would cut that base program.
Yes.
Yeah.
Thank you. And Ray, it's good to see you. Ray was there for the first.
Yes. He used to have a hair.
I know. So when I knew Ray, he had a really generous head of hair. So it's really exciting 10 years later to see that now the final Senate Bill 1010 plan has been adopted. And the question I have and how this relates to this KPM is, so is your staff now the same folks who are involved in implementation or development of those plans? Are you shifting them now to implementation of those plans? Because I think a lot of folks don't realize that, you know, development of the plans is one thing, but now we're really where the rubber hits the road, which is implementation of these plans. And I don't recall seeing a policy option package or anything that makes that transition. So I'm assuming you're going to just have those staff transition into implementation now.
Chair Devlin, Representative Dinkel, that's exactly what happened. And in fact, we started that transition almost immediately because we had some plans that were in place. Those staff have will continue to monitor the plan itself, continue to do biennial reviews with the local advisory committees to see how they need to be updated, what's working, what's not. They're continuing to do outreach, continue to work with the soil and water conservation districts to maximize the work that they do. We do have compliance work that we need to do as our rules come into effect, and these staff are the ones that go out and do the investigations and develop the course of action with those individuals where there is a problem. Work with our counterparts in those areas, whether it's ODFW or DEQ, to continue to look at opportunities to improve things. So, yes, so they're right in the midst of implementation right now.
Just a follow-up to that, is there any way to have a KPM that tracks compliance? I understand that it's not a permitted system, so it's different from, for instance, with a CAFO and you have an MCPS permit, since there isn't a permit per se with the Senate Bill 1010 plans. But is there a way to, or you have internal tracking that says, you know, for each, how many, there's 36 plans, is that right?
39.
How many of each plan, you know, how we're doing in meeting the goals, and, you know, are we meeting our target as far as, you know, with the dates that are set out and the goals that are set out in those plans?
Chair Devlin, Representative Dinkfeld, yes, we do have data tracking that all of our compliance actions, whether they're result in a compliance action or saying they're in compliance, we track all that. We don't have a performance measure, I don't believe, not even a secondary one on that. The program was new enough that we didn't see where we needed to go there. Just as a side note, one of the most interesting things is the largest majority of our compliance actions are related to small 1 to 10 animal operations. Most of our time is spent in that area for compliance. And in terms of numbers, we're looking at, you know, probably about 70 complaints a year right now. Of course, it's been increasing over time, not because more has happened, but because more people have become aware of our program and because more plans have come into place and more people are referring complaints to us.
The customer service measure that was adopted by all state agencies after last legislative session. And we actually did our first survey a year ago, February 15, 2006 through March 31st, 2006. So we send out surveys based on statistical, all that good stuff, to our customers. And you can see the response from that initial survey. There are the six components to the survey that was required of every state agency, five components, and then the overall rating. So the components were timeliness, accuracy, helpfulness, expertise, and availability of information. And you can see the breakdown of the percentage rated good or excellent in each of those subcategories. And then the overall rating was at 91.9%. And you can see the number of responses that we got. We were at, you know, around 550 overall responses. We're actually now just getting ready to send out our next survey, our second survey, and we're picking different quarters every year to survey. And so we'll have a couple of additional years of responses when we come back before the legislature. Well, I guess if we're back next year, one more year of response.
At this point, maybe we'll go on to policy option packages, and maybe we can get through about three.
Perfect. So under the next tab, you see the list of our program option packages. We have 14 of them. One is not really ours, but we'll talk about it. And I think I'd like to just start out by identifying for you, because you see the list of the packages, package A, B, D, and J. We have, as you saw in our overview, the majority of our programs are funded with other funds through fees, program fees. We have four of our programs that are needing a fee increase. These are fee increases to maintain the current program. They are not enhancements of the program. fee increases in our livestock program, our weights and measures program, our pesticides program, and our shipping point fee increase, shipping point program. What we do in our agency and what we did in this last interim is we pulled together an advisory committee for each of these four programs, representatives of the industry that pay the fees, and those advisory committees spent on average a year plus with us going through the program in great detail, looking at every expenditure. And as a result of those efforts, we tweak, revise, change the program to try to keep it as efficient as possible and meet the needs of the industry. And then I believe that we have support for each of these fee increases. I hope that on Wednesday you will hear public testimony to that effect. It's been the case as we've moved through the substantive committees in this body. So I feel good. I feel good about the work that we have gone under. It is never fun to go through a fee increase process, as you can well imagine. So going to the first package, package 200 is our livestock fee increase. The livestock program is part of our Animal Health and Identification Division. This is the program that records all livestock ownership brands, inspects all cattle and horses when they are sold for proof of ownership, tracks down stolen animals, and those kinds of things. If we were to not get the fee increase, it would mean a loss of 11.8 FTE in 23 positions. I think that represents half the program, roughly. Third to half of the program. So it would be a pretty significant hit on the program if the fee increase was not approved. And the other funds limitation for the fee increase is the $1.2 million plus $70.
Yes. It's the driver of the cost increase. Or one other. So where are we going to get to that someplace along the line?
Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson, the primary driver, and you'll see it consistent through all programs, is we go through fee increases periodically. And then when you have a fee increase, your cash balance builds up. So you live off of the cash balance for a time. What inevitably happens is when you initially increase your fees, your revenues are higher than your expenditures, but over time that switches. But we don't come back for a new fee increase until we're running out of cash. So we've operated for a few years in the livestock program and in our other programs where our expenditures have been higher than our revenue. We know that. We know we have to circle back in when our cash balance gets down to the point where we can no longer operate the program. I think one of the things that we have learned through this process is trying to manage a little more finely the program and raise fees at a smaller increment, but more often. Because in some cases, I think our measurement standards program, it's been 10 years since we've had a fee increase, and so we're looking at a fairly significant fee increase. And the industry doesn't realize that you haven't had a fee increase in 10 years. They just see, what do you mean you're looking at a 40-50% fee increase? We can't afford that.
More inspection going on, or is it just the cost of wages and health care?
Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson, it's all of those things. The staffing costs, the travel costs, fuel costs. We have also seen in the livestock program a reduction in the number of animals. So the revenue is not coming in as high as before. In this program, when you have a number of animals, like at a feedlot that are sold, you can inspect a lot in a small area, but we also have ones, twos, threes that are sold in great distances, so our inspectors have to travel a long way. Those were some of the factors that we looked at with the advisory committee. Do we want to charge a mileage fee on top of that? But in essence, what that means is the smaller numbers are paying a lot more costs. So those were all the things that the advisory committee looked at.
Katie, what percentage of fee increase does this represent?
$0.75 to $0.85. Mr. Chair, Representative Garrard, current inspection fee is 75 cents a head. This would take it to 85 cents a head.
When was the last time this was increased?
Mr. Chair, in 1987. And just for your information, the livestock industry in our state happens to be probably one of the most conservative elements, and they poured through our numbers with a fine-tooth comb.
Gas prices in 87 were probably in the $1.08. Yeah,
sure. I love to give this lecture, but because of my experience in owning my own radio stations, I found out that if I did a 5% increase every year, my clients didn't object. But if I waited every 3 years and did a 15%, that's when they would holler. So perhaps you might reevaluate going, 18, 19 years between rate increases. That's really not very good policy, in my opinion.
Mr. Chair, Representative Grard, you're right. It's again, I think the culture in our agency, we've done that in all of our programs, and we've really kind of got hit on the side of the head last session in our food safety program. The same thing, the fees have not been increased since 1987. Significant fee increase. We worked with the industry, and what we have now in statute is a 2% per year increase in our food safety program. We're looking at doing that in our weights and measures program. So I think we are shifting internally with managing our fee programs that way, because you're absolutely right.
Why don't we do one more?
One more?
And then the House members have to be on the floor at 10,
yes.
So we'll give them a couple of minutes to... What? I thought you were just being a disgruntled House member.
Mr. Chair, Package 201, this is the fee increase for our weights and measures program. This is the program that does our motor fuel quality, as well as all of our all of the weighing and measuring devices in the state. So we're in grocery stores, food processors, livestock scales, anything that weighs or measures, we inspect it. Another situation where our last fee increase was 1992. It's a $1.5 million other funds plus a little bit above that in terms of the limitation increase, 11 positions, 10.45 FTE. The other thing that I need to bring to your attention, if Representative Dingfelder was here, she knows this very well because we talked about it as the biofuels package was going through. We will be responsible for monitoring on the biodiesel side, feedstock production regionally, and when it triggers the whatever the threshold is, we monitor that, and then the standard kicks in, and we will also be doing the fuel quality work for the biodiesel and the ethanol work. We need a fully funded weights and measures program in order to do that work. So that's where we are with our weights and measures program.
Questions? Seeing none, why don't we stop here for today, and we'll just start again tomorrow morning. Don't really anticipate anything. Let's think. We might get through a very good portion of the remaining presentation tomorrow. So.
Mr. Chair, my goal is to get through the whole thing.
Yep. Okay.
And we do have tomorrow, just a reminder, Carol Mallory Smith from Oregon State University will be here to talk briefly about our the renewable energy package that has our canola and alternatives to canola research effort ongoing. She's just going to update the committee in terms of what's going on there. It's not going to be maybe 5 minutes.
If one of the co-chairs would prefer if not use that word too often.
Alternatives to canola is the piece they like.
Okay.
That's why I say canola and alternatives to canola.
Blueberries.
Camelina, flaxseed, sunflowers.
Boy. Hemp. Converting blueberries into biofuels, that would be a waste.
Okay.
Anything else?
Thank you.
Seeing none, we'll close the hearing. And PM, we're adjourned.